Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program, one man's mission to give honor to a group of Mexican nationals killed when the plane transporting them back to Mexico crashed near Coalinga more than 60 years ago, killing them all. Plus, older Americans, why so many are working past retirement age, and their biggest worry. Also, the Fresno Food Expo, how it's growing the market for Valley Ag products. But first, 65 years ago, an airplane disaster in the hills near Coalinga grabbed national headlines and even inspired a song by Woody Guthrie. Now, one local author and members of the Valley's religious community are on a quest to ensure that those who died in that crash are not forgotten. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin brings us this report.
Author Tim Z. Hernandez was digging through old newspapers at the Fresno County Library when a dramatic headline from the late 1940s captured his attention.
I stumbled across, this headline that said 100 people see a ship plunge to the earth or something like that. It was just really a, captivating headline. And I instantly realized after reading that it had to be tied into Woody Guthrie's song, the plane wreck at Los Gatos.
The sky plane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon. Like a fireball of lightning, it shook all our hills. And who are these friends, scattered like dry leaves? The radio says they are just deportees.
That song is called Deportee. The folk musician wrote the lyrics after hearing of a harrowing plane crash that occurred in Fresno County in 1948. The plane, chartered by the U.S. Immigration Service, was transporting 28 Mexican nationals from Oakland to El Centro, near the U.S.-Mexican border. The plane's wing caught fire and broke off, scattering body parts through Los Gatos Canyon near Coalinga. W.L. Childers, who lived on a ranch in the canyon, witnessed the crash and its aftermath. His quote ran in the Fresno Bee in 1948.
The plane was headed east, about a mile high. I was watching it when I noticed a streak of smoke trailing off the left motor. The left wing then separated from the body of the plane and the fuselage, and the right wing began to spiral down toward the earth. As I watched, I could see bodies separating from the wreckage as they either jumped or were thrown clear. W.L. Childers, January 28, 1948.
All 32 on board, including the flight crew and an immigration officer, died. The crash made national news, but the names of the victims did not. Locally, the Fresno Bee published some names, but an Associated Press article that ran in the New York Times the day after the crash only named the crew. It simply referred to the passengers as 28 Mexican deportees. That angered Guthrie and inspired his song. In it, he assigned symbolic names to the victims. It's performed here by Woody's son, Arlo Guthrie.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be deportees.
As Hernandez reflected on the news accounts of the tragedy and the song lyrics, he instantly knew he had another book idea.
Looking at these 28 lives that had perished in this plane crash in 1948 and that didn't, have the dignity of their names afforded to them in the media at the time, it was something that I just felt compelled to want to find their story or put their story back.
For Hernandez, piecing the story back together 65 years later has become a multi-year journey. His goal is to reconstruct the accident and the lives of the people impacted by it.
For me, that's what the book is about. It's about capturing the sort of ripple effect of all the lives that this one tragedy touched, back then and even today.
That journey took him to the site of the crash. It's located in a quiet, lush canyon.
It's nice here. It's like someone's backyard. You know, it's very pretty. It's a cow field right now. We had to step over the cow pies on our way out here, you know. It's very nice, pine trees, canyon, creek right here. But it's a very famous crash site right here also.
That's Coalinga resident Larry Hawes. His mother was just a child when she saw the wing of the plane fall off and land just steps from her grandmother's home. He, of course, didn't witness the crash, but he was willing to show me where it happened. We climbed under some barbed wire and walked through a field to reach the site, which today is unmarked.
The plane came in and barely made it over this little ridge here we see to our right. And it was spiraling, and it barely made it over that, and it crashed head-on into this creek bank right here, and it caught these three trees on fire.
Hernandez also connected with Hawes' aunt, June Lee Austin, who was almost 10 years old when the plane crashed near her home in the canyon.
I didn't see the plane go down, although several members of my family did. I arrived there on the school bus after it was down and when they were still pulling the bodies out.
She recalls that parts of the passengers' bodies were strewn across the canyon.
There were bodies scattered all over. So it took a lot to even find everybody and or all the pieces, I should say. I don't know that there were any bodies totally intact, and none were identified. And they were mainly just bits and pieces.
Austin, who is 74, remembers the incident like it was yesterday.
It was a horrendous thing, and I don't know if it was worse on me as a child or not, but it certainly stayed with me all my life, the sight and the smells and everything that happened.
We died in your trees and we died in your bushes, both sides of the river, we've died just the same.
But Hernandez says a major component of this story is still missing. Hernandez combed through records to properly identify, as best he could, the 28 Mexicans who died in the crash. He recites the names in this version of Deportee, which he recorded with Fresno musician Lance Canales.
Miguel Victor Alvarez. Francisco Llamas Duran.
He has learned a little about them. He's determined that some were braceros, or guest agricultural workers. One person, he says, had a laundry workers' union card in his back pocket. Another worked in a foundry in Sacramento.
What I don't have, though, still at the end of the day, are the voices of the 28 people who died on board. Virtually nothing about how to locate the surviving families of these plane crash victims, the 28 quote-unquote deportees, and or quote-unquote Mexican nationals, I should say. That's why I feel like right now, I'm not satisfied with moving forward with the book at this point until I feel like I've just exhausted every resource to try and find that family.
That's where this historical event becomes a modern-day community endeavor. If you were reaching out to those families, what would the message be?
Call me.
Hernandez acknowledges that any descendants of the crash victims could be several generations removed. But if a grandchild or great-grandchild has even a photo of one of the victims, that would make a difference.
You know, sometimes just seeing the photographs can speak, you know, volumes, as we all know. You know, even that would be something, you know, putting the face to their names.
There's another way that Hernandez is breathing new life into this story and its characters. He learned that the 28 Mexican citizens were buried in Holy Cross Cemetery in Fresno. Their graves are marked with one headstone.
It's a 12 by 24 bronze memorial. As you can see, it's weathered, it's patinaed. It says 28 Mexican citizens who died in an airplane accident near Coalinga, California on January 28, 1948. Rest in peace.
Carlos Rascon is the director of cemeteries for the Roman Catholic Diocese of Fresno. He, like Guthrie and then Hernandez, was moved to learn that the 28 people were buried without their names inscribed on a headstone.
There's people that are buried here that are John Doe's, Jane Doe's. And if you had a family member that went missing, and later on you find out that they're actually at a cemetery and they have no names, that would strike me as, why? Like, why isn't their names there? It's unsettling to me. It's almost like it's unfinished.
Rascon and Hernandez came up with a plan. They are raising $10,000 to establish a memorial to the victims of the plane crash. The memorial will include the names of each of the 28 Mexican citizens.
My idea, as far as the inscription, is to have one leaf represent each of the 32 people. 28 of them are here, but the other four were buried elsewhere. And if you hear Woody Guthrie's poem, it says that they were scattered like dry leaves on our topsoils.
Is this the best way we can grow our big orchards? Is this the best way we can grow our good fruit? To fold like dry leaves and to rot on your topsoil and be known by no name except deportees.
Hernandez encourages people to embrace this part of our history.
We want the community to feel that this is part of their history as well. Not just California history, but, you know, American history, as Woody Guthrie sort of told us. And at the end of the day, I mean, our names are really what we have.
And all they will call you will be deportees.
Jesus Mesa Santos, Baldomero Marcos Torres, presente.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Now you can see the photos from the site and listen to a playlist featuring everyone from Bruce Springsteen to Willie Nelson performing Woody Guthrie's song, Deportee, online at kbpr.org. Now, joining us, we do have Tim Hernandez, an award-winning author and performance artist. He is also writing a book about this plane crash, tentatively titled All They Will Call You, and also KBPR reporter Rebecca Plevin. Both. First of all, Rebecca, let me tell you, great report.
Thank you.
Very good report. Tim, first of all, I'd like to know how you two kind of came together on this particular story. I'll start with Rebecca, and then, Tim, you can join in.
Sure.
Sure. Thank you.
So a couple of years ago, I first met Tim. He's an amazing writer, and he's written some really great books that really capture the feeling of the Central Valley and his characters. And I think he does a great job of really bringing the Central Valley to life through his writing. And so I've interviewed him a couple times about his books and his work. And so when this project came up, he sent me a message, and I thought it would be a great story that we could help him get the word out about both the project he's doing and his efforts to reach out to the community.
And so with you, Tim, you are originally then from the Valley.
Yeah, that's right. I was born and raised there, between Tulare County and Fresno County.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Why was it so important for you to take on this project?
Well, something that I've learned a while back in this writing business anyway is that, you know, when the muse knocks on the door, you answer. That's pretty much how this story came to me also. As Rebecca mentioned, I was working on a previous book that also took place in the same, very much in the same time, actually, 1948, 1947. And in doing that research, I ended up stumbling across this newspaper article and about the plane crash, and instantly just these stories started to kind of come to me, and ideas started to spring to me. And I do what I do with all good ideas. I write them down, and I file them away, and if they keep knocking on my mind, after a period of time, then I have to listen to them, and that's what happened here.
What was it about this incident? Like you said, this story just kept coming back to you. What was it about it that made you want to pursue it?
Right. Well, it was, I think the most intriguing thing was I thought, these are 28 people. They could just not fall off the face of the earth. You know, these are 28 lives, 28 of them. And I thought, at the very minimum, their names, what are their names? At least their names. You know, that curiosity that I've had since I was a child, I know that one that we've all had in us, that the question is why? And that was something that just kind of it kept nagging at me, which was why? Why don't we know their names? These are 28 people. They can't just fall off the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. So originally the idea was, well, I'm just going to find out the names. I didn't really intend to kind of go seeking to find out what their lives were like or any of that. I just wanted to find out their names originally. But once that happened, I ended up sort of just, like I said, scratching beneath the surface, and sort of suddenly this sort of wellspring of information started to come forth about who they were and all that. So,
what you know now about the victims, what you've been able to come find out in your research, what was it like for you going back to the crash site with that kind of knowledge? And Rebecca, I'd also like to hear how you felt about going back there too. But let's start with you, Tim Hernandez.
Sure. Yeah. You know what? After that day, I've for about a year before I went to the crash site. Actually, it was at the crash site I had been working on this. So I instantly started to build up, you know, an idea of what it looked like and kind of just a real fictional, you know, version of that in my mind. But once I stepped out there into that canyon, in the quietness of the canyon, in the sort of serenity and also the kind of haunting kind of feeling that still, I think, hangs in the air there. And once I was out there, you know, just the gravity of it really was, it's a whole different kind of weight. That song takes on a whole new meaning and weight when you're standing in the gorge at the spot of where these lives perish, where that plane hit. All the lyrics take on a completely different meaning. And that was something that I instantly went back and started to write on, was my first impression of that. I started taking notes in that moment of what that feels like, you know, what that sort of feels like to stand there in that place, in that cavity.
What about you, Rebecca?
I think Tim captured it really well. I think when you go out there, I mean, you drive out to Koh Lingga, and then you have to drive about 18 or 20 miles into this canyon. It's this winding road, and as you go up, you go from the valley floor, and then you get up there, and there's pine trees, and it's very lush. And it's so quiet and untouched, and it's hard to imagine the type of horror that must have been there 65 years ago. You hear the accounts of this accident, and it's hard to imagine the horror of it, given that it is so peaceful and quiet and untouched. Right. I mean, there's old, very old homes there, and there's a lot of history there. It's really hard to imagine what it must have been like there.
Oh yeah, that canyon is rich with history, and I'll tell you something. That canyon's also it's an airplane corridor, so there's still planes that fly over that route. You know, obviously not that close to the canyon, but they fly over that route. And when we were out there for our first visit, there were a couple of planes that flew straight over that route. And it was just sort of awe. I had my jaw open just looking up at this plane and thinking to myself in that moment. You know, we actually captured some of that on film, too. So, yeah.
Yeah, and actually in my audio, you can actually hear some planes going by, too.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Tim, Mr. Hernandez, you talked about wanting to see how this crash impacted other lives. What have you been able to discover thus far?
Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. The crash did impact, you know, other lives beyond the victims, the 32 victims that died there. But, you know, there are the eyewitnesses, the sort of first responders, you know, and June Lee Austin is one of them. Larry Haas's mother, Nancy, is another one who saw this. In fact, Nancy Haas, you know, she saw this as an 8-year-old around there, and she was affected the rest of her life. She couldn't fly an airplane. She was, you know, just mortified to get in an airplane for the rest of her life. And then you have, you know, how it rippled across the sort of the whole country in terms of how Woody Guthrie picked it up and decided to write about it. And it continued on and on. It touched a man named Martin Hoffman. It touched his life enough that, you know, he's the one who actually wrote the melody to the song that we all know today, and who's also kind of a nameless person in this whole situation. But, you know, the song and the song continues to live on today and touch the lives of people, you know, just anyone who's really sort of, you know, who comes into contact with the song. It really is a touching song. And I think what it does is it brings us the humanity to the situation.
You know, have you found that those people that you've been able to go back and talk to who have been impacted by this, those who witnessed the crash and everything else, have they really appreciated the fact that they're able to tell their stories?
Yeah, they really have, and I know at least in the case of the Red Childer's family there, the ones who own the ranch there, which is June Lee Austin and her family, her father and them, Happy and all them. They had that area for, I mean, they've had that property there for years. And I know one of the things she said is right after that crash, they her family spent years talking about it, you know, just kind of processing that over and over. And they thought that the more they could tell it, she, in her own words, actually, the more that they felt the more they could say the story and retell it, maybe the more it would sort of heal him in some way. And, you know, I don't know, you have to ask her if it's worked or not, but I know that the tragedy is still certainly clear and vivid in her mind, in her family's mind.
Have you found out, like those who were instrumental in writing this song, and what was it about it for them? Because, you know, some people have brought up that there are plane crashes where people, their names, you know, all the passengers, their names are not mentioned.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I think when we want to examine like the writing of the song, you have to kind of put it in the context of what Woody Guthrie was at that time to have sort of grasped the idea. Even you're right, because it happened so frequently. You know, 1 year prior to In fact, this is something kind of a haunting note. 1 year prior to the accident, almost to the date, February 1947, Woody Guthrie's daughter, his youngest daughter, Kathy Ann, was killed in a fire. And it was because of an electrical, sort of a faulty electrical wire. And he ended up writing a letter to a friend of his at that time, almost a year before, basically complaining about the system, saying, you know, there's these faulty wirings and these cheap synthetic wirings that we're just trying to make more money off of instead of, you know, worrying about people and their lives. And he said, and it's these cheap synthetic wirings that bring our airplanes down from the skies and people's faces get marked out in the fall.
Mm.
And this is like 1 year prior to that, you know. So, and Woody Guthrie, I got to talk with Nora Guthrie at the Steinbeck Center last year. Something she said to me just really kind of took me. She said, you know, my father, he knew the power of names. My father knew the power of names. And some songs, he just invokes a name over and over, and that's all he does. He just says, I just want to sing your name. You know, so he kind of was in this place already. So when this happened, I think it was just sort of an intersection that was inevitable.
Rebecca, you look like you want to join in here. Oh, go right ahead.
I did want to give Tim a chance, too, because I know we've talked about the witnesses of this crash and the people behind the music. I know Tim has been doing so much work to find out information about the victims of the crash, and he's done a lot of research into the, especially the 28 Mexican citizens, and I know he's done some great research and is looking for more, so I wanted to give chance. I was hoping that Tim could talk about that as well.
And talking about, I wanted to get to that as well, as far as what you've been able to find out about the victims. And I think, too, probably for, you know, maybe the first time, we might hear who those people really are.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do that. I'd love to read their names on the air.
Tell me what you've been able to discover about them thus far, and then let us know their names.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, there's certain degrees of folks that I'm looking to contact because they had some connection, either with the families or people also that were around in Fresno. In fact, one man, his name is Juan Mercado, I'm looking for. From my understanding, he's passed away. He was once a radio DJ in Fresno, and I think one of the first bilingual radio DJs in Fresno. And it's reported here that he actually sent a nice bouquet to the, you know, to the funeral during that time. And he's someone that, you know, if the family, you know, I'd love to speak with the family, kind of just to get their father or their grandfather's sort of sentiments about the whole idea. You know, I really want a good context of what the community itself was feeling during that time. So that's someone also. Another woman, her name is Miss Mary Rios from a Fresno County area, Joaquin Maciel of Madera. These are people now that contributed some either donation or floral arrangement to the funeral during that time in 1948. But, you know, it'd be great to reach out to them. Now, as far as the airplane, the folks, the victims themselves, some of the things, you know, one of the most, I think, sort of compelling bits of information that's emerged from this research, and that's between Carlos Rascon's fantastic work there and my work, and that's that, you know, originally in some of the first reports, there was only one Mexican deportee woman, a female, you know, aboard, and the other 27 were males. And then at one point, too, they were saying one of them was anonymous. They didn't have a name for one of them. Then later reports start to say that there might be two females, maybe. Well, in Carlos Rascon's work and my work, we discovered that it looks like there's actually three Mexican females on board, which we have the names for. And so, you know, there's that kind of information. One of them, actually, one of the gentlemen wasn't from Mexico at all. I've discovered he's actually born in Spain, originally from Spain, was born there in Spain.
Well, you have you've done a lot of research. And what were those victims' names? I know you wanted to be able to have that time to at least read their names.
Sure, yeah, this will probably take about a minute here, so I'm going to go ahead and read the names, and, you know, so these are the names. First time I get to read them on the air, so thank you for this opportunity. Miguel Negrodos Alvarez, Francisco Llamas Duran, Santiago García Elizondo, Rosario Padilla Estrada, Tomasa Avena de García, Bernabe López García, Salvador Sandoval Hernández, Severo Medina Lara, Elías Trujillo Macías, José Rodríguez Macías, Tomás Padilla Márquez, Luis López Medina, Manuel Calderón Merino, Luis Cuevas Miranda, Martín Razo Navarro, Ignacio Pérez Navarro, Román Ochoa Ochoa, Ramón Ramírez Paredes,
Apolonio Ramírez Plasencia, Guadalupe Laura Ramírez, Alberto Carlos Fragosa, Guadalupe Hernández Rodríguez, María Santana Rodríguez, Juan Valenzuela Ruiz, Wenceslao Ruiz, José Valdivia Sánchez, Jesús Mesa Santos, and Baldomero Marcos Torres, presente.
Thank you so much, Tim Hernandez. It does make a difference when you hear the names. Thank you both, Rebecca Plevin, for that great report, and Tim Hernandez. I'm Juanita Stevenson.
And I'd like to just leave your viewers or listeners, with the website so that they can contact me or donate if they want to contribute also. And that's timzhernandez.com.
Okay. Okay, Tim. And we will have information up on our website as well.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you for the opportunity. Huh? Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
From the financial crisis of 2008 to the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, recent events have put corporate crimes in the spotlight. But what happens when corporations try to use the tax code to skirt their criminal responsibilities? On this edition of our commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business professor Ida Jones says it's time for companies to pay up.
Don't do the crime if you can't do the time. In other words, if you're not prepared to pay the consequences, don't engage in risky behavior. And if you do and get caught, then take your medicine. Those principles of responsibility and fairness should apply to corporations. But because corporations can take tax write-offs of some criminal fines they have to pay as ordinary costs of doing business, corporations aren't bearing the full responsibility for their crimes. Let's take a look at a recent example. Remember the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill into the Gulf of Mexico? 11 people died, and BP caused billions of dollars in harm and damages to people, businesses, animals, and the environment. In January 2013, a federal judge approved a $4 billion settlement of the criminal charges. According to a recent Wall Street Journal article, BP pled guilty to, among other things, 11 counts of felony manslaughter, and one count of lying about the size of the spill. If BP deducts that settlement as a cost of doing business, then it will not have borne full responsibility for its crimes. It's up to the Justice Department to ensure that BP can't and doesn't deduct the settlement from its taxes. It's up to other agencies, including the EPA, to do the same to ensure that BP pays the full costs of its crimes. So why does it matter whether the settlement is tax deductible? There's several reasons. First, the tax code already prohibits businesses from deducting criminal penalties as ordinary costs of doing business. That's to make sure individuals and businesses bear the full costs of their crimes. But corporations sometimes get around that by claiming that some or all of the settlements in criminal cases are to compensate, not punish. So let's close that loophole. Second, if a corporation deducts criminal settlements as costs of doing business, then in essence, the costs of the criminal conduct are passed on to taxpayers, who have to pay higher taxes to make up for any lost revenue. And last but not least, allowing this tax deduction reduces criminal law's deterrence effect. Since one of the key purposes of criminal prosecutions is to deter criminal conduct, allowing tax deductions for costs of that conduct means that corporations don't fully pay. And full payment is especially important since the corporations themselves can't suffer the other criminal penalty, jail time. What can we do to make sure companies bear the full consequences of their crimes? The key solution is to change the tax code to prevent companies from deducting any portion of criminal settlements as a cost of doing business. Since 2003, Senators McCain and others have introduced legislation to limit or eliminate companies' ability to deduct these settlements from their taxes. These attempts have failed. That's unacceptable. A second solution is for agencies to publish the real amounts of fines after taxes. More accountability for both government and the companies. If this doesn't change, businesses are not doing the time or taking responsibility for their actions. Taxpayers are footing the bill. That needs to change. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. One of the top financial worries of Americans today is that come time to retire, they will not have enough savings to support them through their golden years. That's according to a recent Gallup poll. The poll also showed that the working age in the U.S. is increasing, rising from 60 in the 1990s to 67 in 2012. We ask working seniors in the Central Valley about why they have chosen to work beyond retirement age. 89.3's Ezra Romero has this report.
The world for the retiree is evolving. For some, retirement means a chance to globetrot or travel across the country in an RV. But for many, 65 is just another milestone, a reminder of poor financial decisions earlier in life, or a chance to explore a second career. In short, 65, the usual retirement age, has widened for many Americans because of the cost of living, including medical expenses, has risen drastically from when most seniors started their careers. We asked a few Valley seniors why they are still working past 65.
I don't know exactly what it means to retire. If it means stop working, I have no plans whatsoever to do that.
That was Felipe Barraza. He's 68, a general contractor in Visalia, father of two college students, and his youngest daughter is 13. With all that, Barraza says retirement is a long way out for him. But even when he does retire, Felipe says he plans to travel the world with his wife. Frank Charton, 78, a certified public accountant in Fresno, couldn't agree more.
I'm going to keep going till I can't. You know, if I drop dead or I get Alzheimer's so bad that I can't remember what I'm doing, then I'll quit when I have to.
Charton also says that many seniors work well past retirement or reinvent themselves because they fear falling into the trap of what he calls uselessness.
You just hear about so many people that retire and then all of a sudden, you know, they just start going downhill.
Is that a fear of yours?
Yeah, somewhat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I figured, you know, if I stopped, I might go downhill and I don't want to do that.
Uselessness is exactly what Barraza is living to combat. He says that working keeps both his mind and body young.
I'm 68, and I still run marathons, you know, that's 26.1 miles, and I still do that. And I still play racquetball, and I still go to the gym. At 68, I mean, I really feel great physically.
Barraza is on his fifth marathon and fell 2 minutes short of the qualifying time for his age bracket to make the cut for the Boston Marathon. Tom Haverty, 73, and a commercial plumbing estimator in the Fresno area, is as energetic and youthful as Barraza. But he says in order to maintain the lifestyle he's lived, he needs to work.
It was probably 50-50. I'd put some money away and I'm, you know, got a decent Social Security check, and I don't have any second homes or boats or planes or anything like that. But Social Security isn't enough, and what I have put away wasn't going to last me forever. We haven't really done anything spectacular. We call it normal, our normal life, and the working has made that easy to do.
Haverty remembers when his parents ran out of money during retirement.
That's one of my biggest things is my parents ran out of money in their 90s, and I just, you know, that's kind of a fearful thing that you don't want to do that. So working definitely is probably 50-50. It's nice to have the money. We would be much poorer without it, but it's really enjoyable and it keeps me going.
And that's where all three of these men agree. Reliance on pensions, Social Security, and savings don't fit the bill anymore for seniors when retirement comes around. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
Thank you, Ezra. Now, joining us is Dr. Tom Jones, founder of Work, Inc., a management engineering firm based in Carmel, California. Dr. Jones has spent 30 years in corporate America as a consultant to Fortune 500 companies, private businesses, and public agencies. We also have Pauline
Jones, Dr. Jones' wife. She's also joining us. Dr. Jones, first of all, thanks so much for being here, and you too, Mrs. Jones. We know that there are a lot of people working past retirement, some out of necessity, some because they lost their jobs during the recessions and had to use their savings. And so they're having to work because they didn't have enough. But we also know that a lot of people are working just because they want to.
That's true. That's very true. I'm in that category. Listening to Ezra's report, it's fair to say the age. I'm 73. It doesn't feel like it. Still got a, you know, the mind of a 16-year-old.
Is that part of it?
I think.
Because when you take a look at the way we're aging today, you can ask people in their 60s and their 70s, and they're like, wait a minute. You know, whatever our idea of that age is, that is not the case anymore.
No, not at all. And I have to give a big credit to my wife for that, because she's been supportive of all of the cockamamie things I've gotten into over the years. And sometimes, doubtfully, I've finally learned in the last 25 years to listen to her and not go off half-cocked. But the category, this is kind of a research area for me, because I do a lot of coaching of executives, and particularly people who are eligible for retirement. And if you're eligible for retirement, why are you working? Because the minute you're eligible, you're on half pay. And once they realize that, they say, I can get half of the money or something greater than half right now, and then go out and do what I always wanted to do. And the people that I know that go on, and I know some people that are in their 80s and 90s that are very active mentally, people in my wife's profession, she's a painter, there's some men and women that are well past retirement age that act young, think young, and have a long life ahead of them, and they're making plans to fill that life.
Let's talk about two things. First of all, part of the thing that you mentioned, and your wife can join in here, is that how do you prepare for this? Let's say if you're coming up to retirement age and you're lucky and blessed enough that you do have some retirement, how do you transition into that second job, that second career, as far as something you've always wanted to do?
Well, why don't you respond to that? Because you've always wanted to be a painter. You always wanted to paint full time. And one of our reasons for moving to Carmel was that I could become the secondary supporter and support her in her work.
No, what did you do before you decided to become a painter full time?
Well, I was full time helper to my husband. I helped him sometimes in the business, in the office, and I stayed home with the children.
And that's a job.
And part, yes, and part-time. Yeah. I did go to various art classes that I could find and, you know, hone my skills sort of thing.
So once the children grew up and your husband transitioned into another phase probably of his business, you decided, okay, now it's my turn. Which a lot of women do who stayed at home and raised children.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about my husband. When we did move to Carmel, he said, it's your turn. So it's my turn, and I'm painting more. I'm not as much quite as I'd like to because of some health problems, but I'll overcome those soon. And I hope to do a lot more.
And how did you go about doing that, setting it up so that you could give more of your time to painting?
Well, we reserved a room in the house for and made it into a studio that I'd never had before, a real studio. I used to work out in the garage in our house here, and that didn't help much. It was so hot. But and I started just marking a couple of days where I would just devote myself and do nothing but work, paint, or copy from books or listen to, you know, file radio, or listen to the videos I had on my computer and watch those.
And Dr. Jones, would you kind of suggest that, let's say, as I mentioned, a person who is thinking about, okay, I want to do something I've always wanted to do, I want to move into this second career, how do they start kind of planning for that?
Well, I think I've got two people I'm working with right now that are in that category, going back into the workplace after raising a family. There's a book by Richard Bowles. Richard Bowles is famous for What Color Is Your Parachute? He has another book called What Color's Your Parachute in Retirement? And that book has some profound questions that you have to ask yourself. There's three very important. What do I want to do? Where do I want to do it? And who do I want to do it with? And that's what prompted our finally moving to Carmel from Fresno after 32 years here. What did we want to do and where did we want to do it and who do we want to do it with will determine your direction, your location. Then you start looking for, you know, what's possible in that area. The other issue, people look at retirement. I used to give speeches at retirement conferences, and I said, you people have retired, which means you're ready to get tired again. You want to make sure you go into an activity that invigorates you, doesn't wear you out again. You know, 30, 40 years is this particular – go do something that's a little bit different. If you've been mental, go do something physical. So it's not so much as a change but a selection of another route. Many people that I work with in businesses are ready to go. And they need somebody to shove them out the door.
Yeah.
And I
think they're just afraid to take that step.
They're afraid to take that risk. And the big concern, and you mentioned, you know, being blessed earlier, we are both very strong faith. We believe God's going to take care of us one way or the other if we're, you know, frugal with the resources he's given us. Not to worry. Mm-hmm. You know, people want the whole plan. They want the whole thing.
But do you know? But that's what they've been told.
I know,
from financial planners to whatever. You got to have this planned out. You got to have so much in savings. You've got to have this, and you got to have that.
No.
And when people get to a certain age and they look and say, "Oh my God, I don't
you'll,
have
you'll
that."
You'll never get that.
Yeah.
You'll never get. There's enough is never enough. Trust me.
Let's take a look at the situation where people are having to work. You know, there are a number of people out there. First of all, looking at what the recession has done. And the fact that a lot of people didn't save enough money, couldn't save the kind of money that people talk about because they were never paid that much. Mm-hmm. What do you do if you have to work?
Well, I don't think you have a choice. I put out a notice on Facebook when I knew that I was coming on the show and got some comments back from people. And one person commented that her mother has worked her entire life. I happen to know her mother. I know how old she is. I'm not going to share that. She'll never be able to retire. For a number of reasons, and she's going to have to work her whole life. Hopefully, she'll find something that brings her joy and satisfaction. Otherwise, it could be a real drudge and wear you down. The situations that we are in economically and financially, most people who have suffered by that did not do it of their own decisions. It was foisted upon them. You know, try not to get angry about that, dwell on it, and let it eat you apart. Lucky you're alive, stay healthy, and if you do have a job. There are many jobs going to be opening. Figures run from 50 to 65% of people in senior positions in all walks of life are going to be retiring as soon as the economy looks as if it's going to kick up a little bit because they're tired. They're just worn out, and there's vacancies all over the place.
Well, what do you think people working longer will mean for the workplace?
Well, I think it's going to one of the big issues when I'm working with a company that has an older workforce and a younger workforce, you know, trying to overthrow each other is it's called knowledge transfer. How do you take the knowledge that you have? You're an experienced person. I hope you take that as a compliment.
I've known
you for many years.
I am, and can't really hide my age because I've been around so long.
And you have knowledge. So if an organization just sends you know somebody away, that knowledge goes with them. So there's two areas that companies can do to help this out, and that's start thinking about succession planning. You know, who should be filling these slots. And thinking about how you take these people who have all this knowledge and ease them into retirement by giving them a good outplacement package and bringing them back in as a part-time consultant. It's really smart to do that.
That's a great idea.
But our IRS rules, and I don't anybody to think I'm criticizing the IRS, make it difficult to do that.
Right.
So I think
do you think, though, this might prompt some changes only because of the fact of what we've seen, first of all, the shift, and they're expecting this to even have more people once the baby boomers, baby boomers haven't even started. They're just reaching the age of retirement. So You're going to have a lot of those folks who are going to stay in the workplace mm-hmm.
because
longer.
They want to or have to.
So maybe it might prompt some changes in our rules and the way we're used to doing
things. Well, I'm hoping somebody looks a little bit further ahead than the next election in Washington. I don't see it happening for a while, but to the consequences, the long-term consequences of short-term thinking is what we're dealing with now. But we do need some changes in the laws. We need to let people work less and still be qualified for health benefits. That's another thing people don't want to let go of, especially if they want to start their own business. And about 20% of this workforce are going to be enterprising enough to start their own businesses if you let them and encourage them tax-wise.
Right.
So there's a lot of opportunity, a tremendous amount of opportunity. Age is no barrier to success in the workplace.
No,
it just isn't.
You know what? People can't see you, but I can. But having these two here, both, they're so full of energy and excitement and loving what they do. So I think really it bodes well that if you're 65, you don't have to think about it. The whole rocking chair thing goes away.
It does.
Definitely.
Well, thank you both so much. It was just great to have you.
The radio doesn't show the gray. Remember that.
Dr. Tom Jones, founder of Works Management Firm, and his wife, Pauline. Thank you so much for being
here.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.
That was great.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Well, we know agriculture is king here in the Central Valley. We grow a lot of food. So why not use our biggest asset as a way to help grow the economy? That is the idea behind the Fresno Food Expo, developed by Mayor Ashley Swearingen and the local business community. It is a way to grow the region's food industry. So we are talking about Fresno Food Expo. And joining us now is Vincent Ricuti with Enzo Olive Oil and Amy Huerta, business initiatives manager with the City of Fresno. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
And, you know, Vincent just informed me that Pat Ricuti, longtime farmer in the area, that's your dad.
That
so
is my father.
Just, you're just following in the footsteps in a way, but in a different way. Tell us a little bit about, I want to start first of all with the Fresno Food Expo. Last year, it was a big year. We had 85 locally owned food companies that were featured. Is this a way to grow? What does it mean to those food service companies?
Absolutely. We actually started the Fresno Food Expo in 2011 as an economic development tool to help locally owned and headquartered food producing companies in the San Joaquin Valley help get more customers. So we thought we could bring their customers to them. So in our first year, we actually had about 175 buyers that came from local to regional and national retail, including Save Mart, Walmart, Costco, and then food service, large institutions, jails, hospitals, school districts, anyone who buys large amounts of food. And then last year, we actually saw 430 buyers, so over doubled the amount of buyers that are there. And really, what it means for some companies is meeting the right buyer, we've seen, and getting one contract, say per se, at a Whole Foods has increased a company's sales by 35%.
Wow. Vincent Ricuti, what you are the owner?
Yeah, it's my family's company.
Enzo Olive Oil.
That's right.
A lot of us are familiar with it. What did it mean for your product being at the Fresno Food Expo?
Sure. This is our third year as a company being involved in the Fresno Food Expo. Bella Fruta, our store, was involved in the first year, and then we kind of launched Enzo at last year's show. What it has meant for Enzo is just getting out into the public. I mean, this is only our second year in production, so getting it in front of more people and telling our story has been very, very helpful and great for the local market here.
At this year's expo, will we see some new vendors, some new products introduced?
Yeah, absolutely. Last year, as you said, we had 85 locally owned headquartered food companies. This year, you'll see a little more than 100. So, and you'll see them coming from as far north as Stanislaus County down to Kern County. So they're all local companies from all over the valley. So you'll see a little over 100 of them. And then we're expecting about a little over 500 buyers, including international buyers this year as well.
So what we've seen is this grow since its first inception, and people really beginning to look at this as an opportunity for basically those who are producing the product and bringing the people who can buy the product together. So more and more people are learning about our products here and what we have to offer.
Absolutely. Both from the business to business perspective, we hear a lot of retail and food service, they want to be purchasing local products. So where else to get it than the San Joaquin Valley? And then there's also the public event where people from the public purchase tickets in advance at FresnoFoodExpo.com. And they get to come and they get to taste all of these great foods. And it's really encouraged the public to then go out to their local retailers and local restaurants and start asking for local products.
What did you like about the idea of the fact that the product, for instance, your product, is now introduced? I mean, people can buy it here locally, but it's being introduced to markets outside of the region.
Oh, it's fantastic. That's the business model. We want to grow, not just locally, statewide, nationwide, and globally. So because of the Fresno Food Expo, we've had clients, customers from all over the state, you know, buy our products or hear about it, tweet about it, all kinds of different stuff.
Do you think it also inspires, let's say, growers to kind of look at what they grow in a different way and say, you know what, there's something I can do with this. I can find a way to market this, or I can produce it in a way that it becomes something that the marketplace can use? Because you take a look at, okay, we grow olives. But then you think about the, you know what? We can make our own olive oil. Everybody uses olive oil and some other products. So do you think it maybe in a way inspires those in the food growing business to look at their product in another way?
Sure, absolutely. I think, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why we chose olive oil. You know, our family for generations, we have been vertically integrated in everything that we do. And we looked at olive oil as being that next branch to the fifth, to the family tree, to be where we can grow it, mill it, and sell it all under our own label. And whenever you go to food shows, you do get inspired because you see somebody else doing it and you think, why can't I do the same thing? So, and better.
And we're also, I mean, and we see that on a larger level from the business to business. You know, the Fresno Food Expo, I would say, is all about connections and connecting, you know, so now we have local food producers joining together to make one product. For example, last year we saw Pappy's and Homegrown Organic Farms make a guacamole kit with Pappy seasonings and then organic avocados from Homegrown. So you start to see more of those business connections happening.
Wow, that sounds great. This year, you've already talked about how many more companies you are expecting. When is the Food Expo going to be? Are we going to be in a larger venue, or how does that work?
Yeah, we're still in the convention center, but we're moving into Hall 1, again, with a little over 100 food-producing exhibitors. And it's next Thursday, March 14th, the business-to-business portion. So for any local retailers or restaurants still interested in attending, you can still sign up online. And then the public event opens at 5 p.m. and goes till 8 p.m. And again, like our Facebook page for discounts, and purchase tickets online at FresnoFoodExpo.com.
You know, what do you think this can, excuse me, mean for the economy? Because we've often talked about, you know, ag being, you know, our largest industry. But when it looked at other ways you could market ag other than we grow something and then the people who work to harvest the different crops or the various products. But what I think people don't really look at is ag as a broader industry and all the other things, all the other products, markets, whatever that could come from. our food.
And that's exactly why we started the Fresno Food Expo. We really did it as, again, an economic development tool to help food-producing companies. So like Vince was saying, you know, now they have new customers all over the state. So when they're selling to those customers now all over the state, their new olive oils, what they are doing is they're sending product out and they're bringing new dollars into the local economy. So that's really where the impact comes from. So again, like some of the companies talked about earlier, you know, a 35% increase in sales. That means 1 to 2 additional people hired. And again, all new dollars coming into our local economy. And that's what it's about.
Well, I know you have the olive oil. Are you all kind of looking at other products that you might be able to launch? Because you already do a lot, really, with your with the fruit stand that you have. You've just already found a way to market and sell your product.
Sure. So with our olive oil line, this year at the show, we're actually we're reintroducing our infused oils. We have 3 new infused oils, our Meyer lemon, our garlic, and our basil. I have some for you here if you'd like to try them.
I noticed. Sorry, folks, but he's sitting here with his olive oil and some great-looking bread. And, you know, we just might have to break it out here in a little bit.
And also our bold label, which is our Corniki variety of olives. And we're looking to introduce these to the Central Valley. We started it right before Christmas and had a great selling season for them. But now we're ready to go out and start selling them other stores. So that's what we're going to be focusing on this show. And in the future, we want to, you know, add to our product line some balsamic vinegars, some jarred olives,
wow,
that kind of stuff.
Wow.
So.
Because what we also find, not only I think it's an opportunity, I think, to kind of educate our own community about what we have to offer and all that's there, but I think it's so great for outside of the region as well, and getting people familiar with this region and what the growers have to offer.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was really cool. I mean, last year we saw on our Facebook page right after the event people making comments, you know, I went to Save Mart today and I purchased this type of salami because I know it's local, or I purchased, you know, this type of olive oil or this type of sauce, and people get really excited about it. So it's about that community awareness, because again, the community is really the best buyer that we have, because they're the ones that can go into their local stores, local restaurants, and request for, you know, local products, local wine lists, local olive oils. They can do that. So they really are our best advocate.
And you really do find that people, once people understand this and they learn about the products, they really do want to support locally owned companies, businesses, and products.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we see that a lot, especially from the Fresno Food Expo. And I think, you know, I think the Fresno Food Expo, what it does is it brings, you know, that's who we are. We are the breadbasket of the world, and that's what we should be known for. So it gives people a picture of what that looks like, which is really exciting.
So let's talk about the upcoming event. Anything that people should know, those who want to participate? Do they have to get tickets early? Can they get them there? How does that all work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, any retail or food service or any type of buyer, restaurant owners, you can still register online at FresnoFoodExpo.com. As for public tickets, I would highly, because we will sell out. And if we sell out, they will not be there at the door. So you can go right now online to our website, FresnoFoodExpo.com, and purchase your tickets. You can go to the box office downtown. And if you like our Facebook page, we'll be giving out Facebook discounts over the next week for discounts on those tickets. So I would say buy quickly.
Okay. Now you hear it. Which olive oil are we going to try?
We can try all of them. I've poured the Meyer lemon for you to start with.
Okay.
Oh, that infusion.
I'm just going to let people know real quick before we sign off. I can't be eating on the air. That's good.
Right?
It really is.
And just a reminder, all of our products are 100% organic. Every olive that goes in every bottle is grown by my family in Madeira. We mill everything ourselves, and it really is a great product, award-winning as well.
Okay. Well, thank you both for coming in today. Amy Huerta with the City of Fresno and Vincent Ricuti with Enzo Oils. Look for it in your store. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver,
Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.